Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Cameo Launch Short Film Podcast. This episode is something of a treat, as George and I got to sit down, virtually, of course, with Oscar Sharp, director of The Carmen Line, one of our favorite short films. You can find the link to our review in the episode notes. Oscar appeared as part of our new Filmmaker's Choice segment, in which we not only discussed The Carmen Line, but his short film pick, the metatextual animated short film, The Eagleman Stag, from director Mikey Please. Now, just to warn you ahead of time, while we tried initially to speak in broad terms about The Carmen Line, the nature of the story meant that you can't talk about the film in any real depth without spoiling it, so we're putting the spoiler warning up front. Please use the link in the notes to either read our review, which contains a link to the film, or follow the link in the notes that takes you directly to the movie, give it a watch, and then come on back for our breakdown. Another upfront warning: on the night of our interview, George somehow managed to anger the internet gods, and as a result, his video is very shaky. His audio, however, is absolutely fine, so those of you listening to the usual audio-only edition of the episode can enjoy his dulcet tones without interruption and until your heart's content. So, without further ado, please sit back and enjoy our interview with the wonderful Oscar Sharp. We have a very special guest today. Joining George and I is the filmmaker Oscar Sharp, director of The Carmen Line. Thank you so much for being with us today. And you're joining us from the States, is that right?
Yes, I'm here in Los Angeles, which is pretty sunny at the moment, true to form. Although it has been properly bloody cold lately. It was as cold as it was in London last week for most of the week, so...
And I understand that, generally speaking, in the United States as a whole, it's been fairly quiet, nothing of much significance happening over the last couple of weeks or so.
There's a very smooth political transition going on. Absolutely no ferment of potential, risk of civil war. Certainly no major political leaders actively trying to goad half the population into acts of rebellion. It's fine.
Fantastic. Good to see everything's all well and good over there. But nothing going on, have you been able to work on any recent projects? I know, obviously, with everything happening around the election, that's obviously that takes up a lot of bandwidth.
Certainly emotionally, although I haven't had any personal work to do in that regard. But you've probably heard from a lot of filmmakers that quarantine has been a great opportunity for development, for getting on with stuff that we otherwise like to avoid, which usually involves staring at problems in screenplays and squeezing our heads like this going, "Yeah!" While we try to figure out how to fix them. Being sort of imprisoned is quite a good way to be forced to deal with that. I spent a big chunk of it working with a wonderful screenwriter on what I anticipate will probably be my first film, and some other people on another one, and which may also be the first one, sort of depending on what happens, and a TV show. So it's been quite good. It's sort of forced my hand and made me get some stuff done.
So The Carmen Line, just an absolutely fantastic short film. Generally with the films that we recommend, I'll come across a really good film. I think, oh, that's fantastic. I'll sort of pop it in the back pocket, get a review written, and then the recommendation comes with the review itself. In the case of The Carmen Line, the second I saw it, I broke with that tradition straight away and immediately got on the socials and told people to just watch it now. I'll get to the review later, but just go find it and watch it. It was an absolutely fantastic film. Mm. So, of course, that film stars Sean Dooley and national treasure Olivia Colman. And would you be able to walk us through the premise of that one and just tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, I mean, the premise is very simple. A mother, sort of probably lower middle class ish mother, who's also lives as a essentially a housewife, is she welcomes her daughter home from school one day, and you know, their relationship is like a lot of teenage daughters and their mothers, and we just sort of see that, and we're sort of watching it going, oh, this is a sort of I don't know, a bit of social realism or something like that, shot brilliantly by Robbie Ryan, who has shot a great deal of some of the most powerful social realism, for Andrew Arnold, for example. And you're sort of watching it going, okay, normal situation. And then just after the daughter goes upstairs, you hear this scream from mum, and she runs back downstairs. Her mum is stuck in the middle of the living room floor. She can't move. And what's weirder is her legs are sort of flapping underneath her, because she has lost her grip on the floor. And they call a doctor because she can't move. And the doctor takes a couple of measurements and announces that she is very, very gradually moving up, straight upwards from where she's standing. And the whole film sort of proceeds from there. That's about the first 4 minutes of 24 that I just ruined, but hopefully it doesn't ruin the rest of it. It's funny. Yeah, this is a big part of the journey with the film. When we first released it, was sort of a lot of intense discussions over, I mean, I sort of didn't want there to be a trailer at all, and one was made, and it saddened me, because as much as a very good trailer and it's exciting and you want to see it, a huge amount of the emotional impact of the film for me depends on exactly what I just described, that you think it's one kind of film and it gradually turns into something else. And that's actually, I think, key to its way of working on audience. It will still work if you watch it knowing everything that's going to happen, like, you know, any story that does that. But I truly think it's more effective if you don't.
The thing that struck me most about it, though, is how out there the core concept is, the core conceit is, but how so normal everything else is around it. You know, so initially you have the condition first takes hold, and Sarah, I believe the character's name is, stuck in the middle of the living room, as you said, and she's starting to lift off the ground. Absolutely no one who sees her comes in and goes, why are you in the middle of the, what, how are you floating in the air? You know what I mean? It's just the fact that, you know, the paramedics arrive and they're trying to get back down onto the ground, and the people that subsequently then come to see her just kind of address it as something that, you know, they've probably seen before. And all of that just kind of plays into the fact that you are watching a real situation and a real family, and all of the whole emotional journey that the three of them go through. It makes it that much more relatable, the fact that you're not dealing with something that is so far removed that even the characters don't really know what it is.
Yep.
And as a result of that, some of the visual associations that occur that are specific to this floating off the ground and slowly rising condition ultimately end up mirroring things that we do recognize. I just think the way that the abstract works with the familiar, I think, is one of the greatest strengths of the film.
There's a few things going on under the hood with that. One of them is, it's really just a feeling that if you think about, like, the stories that have hung around the longest in the world, and the fact that they've hung around the longest probably implying that they have been reliably useful to us as a species, so we have repeated them and shared them with each other. Most of them are fairy tales and myths and other things where sort of impossible stuff happens. That's something that I always loved as a kid anyway, which is, like, stories of where magical things go on, are useful. But of course, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be told in that way, in that sort of familiar, realist way. But realism is a really interesting thing too. Like, any sort of academic about these things will tell you it's sort of a relatively recent invention in a way, or at least as we think of it now. There's a huge upsurge in our understanding of it, weirdly, that tracks with, not that weirdly, that tracks with the evolution of cinema. Why? Probably because cinema was this really fascinating thing we discovered, this strange toy, where at first we were just filming We were just like, oh, I can make a sort of moving photograph of this play. And then we went, wait, if I move the camera into the play and then I cut between different angles, we just invented cutting at angles, this weird thing happens where I feel like I'm sort of there. And that I'm magically in this environment, able to see what's going on, despite the fact that I'm not there, which is what it's always been like imagining things. When I tell you the story of Red Riding Hood and you imagine the forest, you don't imagine that you're in the forest with her. You just imagine she's there in an empty forest. And the same thing happens when you cut between different angles with a camera. So we were successfully simulating this thing about how we imagine. And that, along tracking with like realism in novels and the like, I think pushed us into this assumption that, oh, it should be as realistic as possible. It should be like the world. You can make it like the world, so it should be like the world. And in doing that, we kind of forgot that the most powerful stories, the most useful, helpful stories, the ones that survive, are the ones that take something real and do something to make it unfamiliar, do something to make it strange, magical, thought-provoking. And that it's not surprising to me that those are really useful stories, because it's easier to think about difficult things when they've been reframed as something new, something that you don't already have a bunch of mental rules for thinking about. Long answer. I might have a lot of those today. I'm a bit of a long answer guy.
With that, George, do you want to give us some of your thoughts on it as well?
Please, yes, I'd love to. Absolutely beautiful film. At the end, I was crying. It did have an emotional reaction with me, and I enjoyed in the credits just having a brief little laugh through the tears. With a special thanks to Victoria for letting us cut a hole in her ceiling. That really sort of rang true to me and made me giggle quite a bit. I don't know why, that really did. It was just a nice moment, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. The characters felt so very familiar. It felt like I was watching my older sister and my mum having the sort of arguments and bickering that they had when I lived with them as well, and that felt very familiar, which was great. Obviously very helpful to have an emotional reaction to it, which I enjoyed. I thought it was beautiful. I think anyone can relate to it, and I think it stays with you for quite a while afterwards. I know I've watched it a few days ago and I'm still thinking about it, so absolutely it's a recommendation from me, as it would be, but I loved it.
As George would say, it's beautifully lensed as well.
It is.
The cinematography, again, it is very reflective of normality, but if you actually look at each individual image, some of them are strikingly beautiful, particularly towards the end. Were there any specific conversations you had about the kind of tone or the style that you wanted to hit?
I mean, you know, let's start with... what is it, 80% of directing or something is finding the right collaborators and then letting them do what they're great at. So Robbie Ryan is a goddamn genius. one of the most beautiful eyes I've known in the moving image, I think. And particularly, you know, I knew I wanted the film to feel not unlike one of his collaborations with Andrew Arnold, and so just to some extent, that much frame was part of being enough and making it clear that this should feel intimate and immediate in the way that those stories often do. I said to people right before we started, the genre of this film is social magical realism, or magical social realism, depending on my mood, and taking that British style and using it that way. But yes, along with that, one of my predilections is I love it when there's a stream of images that are doing that work of just pulling you in and not making you kind of look at the screen, but instead just be there with the people. But then from that flow, that river, I like when a salmon of beauty kind of flips up for a moment and glints in the sunlight and drops away, and those frames that hopefully leap out at you do come that way. I think they're sort of this moment I want to cinematize is the word that I often use for this when talking to friends about it. It's to me, to cinematize a thing is to use the tools of cinema, which aren't image but also absolutely sound, to try to take the feeling of this moment and invoke that feeling as completely as possible. And the more specific the feeling, the more interesting that is to me, because we have a large palette of essentially pre-agreed bits of cinematization to produce some very familiar feelings. So I want to make you feel scared. You know, I've got this sort of toolbox of standard ways to do it. But when there's a feeling that I want to tell a story about, which I feel has been not often expressed to me in cinema, or not expressed in, again, a surprising way, to cinematize to me is to find that image, those sounds that will most completely invoke that very particular feeling. And we should not overlook, talking about collaborators, Seb Barker, the visual effects supervisor and creator of most of those shots, you know, working closely with them, of course, but, you know, in the end, I'm just talking and waving my hands about, and he's creating that actual realization of beauty in some cases, but also what that beauty is trying to do to you. And if it succeeds, that's thanks to his craft.
Now, I think it's one of those films that kind of epitomizes the degree to which filmmaking is a collaborative effort and a team effort. And I think it's very much a case of everybody being on board with the overall vision. And in as much as, you know, you say, you know, 80% of it is finding the right collaborators, the final 20 of you communicating to those collaborators exactly what it is you're trying to bring about, and everybody being invested in that vision and in that objective, you know, that's a skill that shouldn't really be overlooked. So
the talking a lot and waving hands about is important to the process if everyone's going to be making the same film together and be excited to do so. But yeah, they make it. That's the funny thing about directors. Like, everyone goes on about them, gives them awards, but they don't make films. They stand near other people annoying them while they make films and try to do it in a way that's effective.
That's interesting. And of course, there's Olivia Colman as well. So how is it that you attracted her to the project?
I mean, it's a while back, so she wasn't the most famous genius in the world at that point, but she was already already pretty well known in the UK. She'd mostly been doing for years, been this sort of staple of British TV comedies, you know, Peep Show and Green Wing. Green Wing was the show where I had realized, I still remember the moment in the show of her. She's playing this like harassed, I think she's an administrator or a secretary, and she's rushing off to get her kids or something. And there was this particular moment in Green Wing where I'm like, oh my God, I think that actress is a genius. Because it was the pathos and reality of it was so potent in the middle of this very absurd show, which of course also appeals to me, to find the sort of, to take something very silly and then to try to find the real and at best somewhat profound, if you can, to mine that. To mine profundity from silliness is like a big quest and a bit hubristic, but fun to try to do. And there she was doing it. So I was like, oh, okay. And then Paddy Considine beat me to the punch, I always think, in that he put her in Tyrannosaur before I managed to get her in something. But that to me is the sort of the first time someone had acknowledged her abilities and tried to make full use of them. But yeah, so that had happened, but not much else in terms of really, you know, making indulging in some of the infinite abilities of Colman had been happening. And I wrote her a letter about why, and about my own mum, who you know, the film's dedicated to her because her cancer had inspired the premise, although I didn't know when I thought of it that it had. It took a while for me to realize that, because the unconscious is a funny old thing. And yeah, I talked to her about that, but also just, you know, getting the right help again. So, you know, one of the producers, Campbell, had a good relationship with Gail Stevens. Is that her name? The casting director of significant renown, and was able to persuade her to send the letter that I wrote to Olivia or to her agent. I forget. It's a long time ago. But that's an important part, it seems, of this, because just rising above the fray is tricky. And then also, I remember very clearly that she hadn't quite read it yet. She'd been busy, I think, when we were in pre-production and we didn't yet know who was going to play the role. And I was very anxious about it because we knew when the shoot dates were. And then I met with Sean Dooley, who, by the way, is also a goddamn genius, and who I hadn't seen that much of his work before, and I watched literally just his reel initially, and in his 30-second or 45-second whatever reel, he made me cry in a what must have been 20-second clip. That man is really goes there. He really goes all the way there, and it you know, when you're empathetic, it gets to you fast. And I sat down with him to discuss it, and he'd read the script and loved it. And he said, who's going to play Sarah? And I said, well, I'm hoping Olivia. And he's like, she is perfect for it. And I'm like, yeah, she hasn't. I don't think she's read it yet. She's been busy. And he's like, it turns out he'd just been working with her recently and they're good friends. And I think he called her straight afterwards or texted her. And the next day she got in touch to say she loved it. And that's actually, probably the most important thing to say about getting a great actor is having a great script. And which brings us to perhaps the most sort of fully infused collaborator in the thing, which would be Dawn, who's a very close friend who I've spoken to today about one of her other projects and one of mine. And yeah, she was entirely necessary to that thing being written because I tried and I couldn't because it was too personal. And yeah, she sat with me for many months of meetings in mainly the National Theatre, because they have really good quiet tables that you can go and sit at for free and just drink water. And she wrote the script that got all of those incredible other collaborators to be involved. Yes, I had to do the talking and hand waving, but if I was talking and hand waving next to not that screenplay, I don't think I'd have gotten half of them.
Yes, I mean, that the screenplay is fantastic. I mean, just in the way it just kind of lays very, very subtle characteristics that when they pay off, it just hits you like a ton of bricks. I mean, to this point, every time my wife just casually says Wunderbar, I'm just like, oh god. Every time.
Yeah, that word is forever changed for me.
I did actually have a question for Oscar. I wonder if you can think back that far when it comes to the Foley itself. I just wanted to know, for the bone snapping moment, was that celery? Was it a carrot? What was it? Because it was very, very grim, and I can still hear it.
Oh my god, that is a good question, and I have known the answer to that. Joe, who did it, I haven't spoken to him since. I think he stopped being a sound designer. Maybe shortly after that film. I hope it wasn't because of me. I remember he was a wonderful artist. I don't remember what he used. I'm so sorry. It might have been stock. It might have been celery. Sorry, man. I can tell you that it was something I was very fixated on. In terms of that cinematization I was talking about, like, we probably worked it for like 2 hours or something, probably to his frustration or the editor's frustration, I forget. But that's exactly the kind of thing as a director where I'll be like, it's not quite upsetting me enough yet. Like, this needs to hurt me.
Yeah. I want to physically wince.
Right. And it can sound right without doing that to you. So you have to keep working.
So this film is about 6 years old at this point. But given the situation we're in right now, it's incredibly prescient, particularly with regard to people not being able to see their loved ones, especially in moments depicted in this kind of film, if they are gravely ill or terminally ill. and being separated at those final moments, and it did ring painfully familiar to the situation we're now in. But despite the fact that it's a good few years old now, I think it only arrived on Vimeo in the last month or so, a couple of months.
And I can directly credit the wonderful Jeff Bowers and his team at Vimeo for, like, I got in touch with him when I realized what you just said, which is that, oh, this is a time when, like, I've received a bunch of messages over the years since putting the film out from people who actively felt it sort of helped them with their grieving process, basically. Made them just by making them feel less alone, really, just by helping them to know that they're not the only person going through what they're going through, which of course people know that, but to have someone come and share those feelings with you, I think some people have found comforting. And so when I realized, oh God, right, it's more relevant in that way than it has been to those emotions. I mean, I wouldn't say it's prescient. It's not about a pandemic, but it is about what it's like to lose someone who you can't see, and also to be dying in isolation. Essentially, she's completely isolated for the whole second half of the film. And so I thought, oh God, like, if this can help anyone in its weird way that it does, it's my responsibility to try and get it to them. So I called Jeff, and yeah, they normally put out things that are much fresher off the mill, you know, but he got it, his team got it, and they staff picked it, and that's been great. I wish I'd had a bit more time to kind of push it while it was getting its first bout of attention, but it got as much in a week as the version that the New York Times put online in the US got in several years, because I think it was understood and appreciated, and of course the staff pick helps.
I'm certain there will have been people out there that will have been able to relate to it, and there's a catharsis that gets delivered at the end of this film that makes the film unexpectedly uplifting, given the journey that you've been on throughout the course of the story.
So firstly, that feeling in the final scene after she's gone, of course it's in the screenplay that her last act was essentially to help bring them back together when they've been in a schism with each other. She starts to heal their relationship. Also, they're doing all sorts of things in that scene which are essentially in tribute to her, such as Wonder Bar. So they connected by their grief. They find there is some hope in that situation. The simple line of direction for that scene for both Chelsea and Dave and Sean was, you're not okay, but you're trying. They ran with that, I think, beautifully. But one other thing worth knowing is that the script actually was a bit longer, and there was another character in it who was shot and cut out of the film.
Oh, right.
I know. It's always what? what? this is definitely doesn't make sense if you haven't seen it. Carly had a girlfriend. She was the cool rock chick from Carly's school when Carly is a dowdy adolescent. And at the beginning, she appeared three times in the film. At the beginning, when Sarah is tidying up, waiting for Carly to come home, she hangs up a coat that Carly's left on the floor, and sees out of the front door window that Carly and this girl Jamie are standing at the garden gate talking. But you can see that Carly is kind of blocking Jamie's way to coming inside, to coming up the garden path. And after she comes in and Mum gives her her dinner, she sits on the end of the couch while Carly tries to ignore her and watches TV, and goes, See, Jamie walked you home again, or something like that. She says the infuriating mum thing to say, and Carly, of course, just rolls her eyes and won't talk about it. And she says, you should invite her in for tea sometime. And of course, Carly just doesn't say anything. Then in the middle of the film, there's a moment that one of the reasons I was scared to cut her out, though it was the right decision, was I wondered if people would wonder about this. So the scene where Dave comes to Sarah for their anniversary and they have what will be their last ever intimate encounter, the sex for the last time. That scene, of course, is in Carly's bedroom because that's what's above the hole.
Yeah.
That's where Sarah is. She's suspended in Carly's bedroom. So where's Carly, right? She's at Jamie's house. So we had a scene in Jamie's bedroom. It was very short and simple. Jamie's sitting on the bed. Carly is pulling out her sleeping bag and laying out on the floor. And Jamie is like, "What? Why did you bring that?" Which is the only line that tells us that they're partners. And I forget exactly what the dialogue was, but what we learned was Jamie's asking her how it's going with her mum, if there's anything she can do, and Carly's just going, "It's fine, it's fine." Because, of course, at this point, Carly is in so much pain that if she shares it with anyone, she will fall apart completely. She's still tight, right? Then you get to the end. The scene you have seen plays out. They're having dinner together. And then the doorbell goes. And Carly gets up and goes to the door. And outside is Jamie. And Jamie, in the background, you can see her car stuffed with things and a guitar in the window because she's off to university. And she got in and Carly didn't. Because as you may recall, Carly was doing her mocks when Sarah was sticking out of her. So, and on the kitchen table, when she comes back in the very end, you'll see that she's reading a A-level physics book because she's doing retakes.
Yeah.
But what happens at the door is Jamie again is like, offers her sympathy and is like, you know, if there's anything I can do, you know, I don't know why you haven't been calling me, whatever. And she moves towards her for a hug and Carly just holds herself and won't let Jamie hug her. And because she's still holding herself together. And Jamie is like, gives a shrug, heads off towards her car. And just before she gets to the garden gate, Carly goes, "Jamie," and she stops and turns around. And Jamie's like, "Yeah." And Carly goes, "Do you want to come in for tea?" In tribute, obviously, to her mum. And Jamie is like, "Yes, I would." Tears in her eyes, comes in, end of film, rise up into the sky. And it just, it was a bit too much. It was too much. It moves me telling that piece of the story now. But I thought of it eventually, this is a bit unfair, it's a bit sort of snarky, but I call it the American ending as opposed to what we did, which is the European ending. Which is the European ending is not as kind to you, doesn't give you something as strong to go, "It's going to be okay." But instead it leaves you with, "We're not okay, but we're trying."
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's amazing. What reminded me of a saying that a tutor of mine used to say all the time is, "Kill your darlings." You can spend ages coming up with the most amazing plot point or the most amazing shot or whatever, but if it doesn't serve the film as a whole, it's got to go. Irrespective of how incredible in isolation that thing may be, you ultimately have to make decisions which are in service to the wider story.
There is another way of putting it that I like. And I forget who I'm quoting, but their way of putting it was, everything you take out makes what's left behind stronger.
Yeah, that's good.
That's a much nicer way of putting it.
No, I love that.
It's more hopeful, isn't it? The first one, "Kill your babies," is this like, ugly. And I see why, because it's like saying, yes, this is going to hurt, right? It's which is good. It's to acknowledge that it's going to hurt, because it does hurt. But also remembering the benefit
is
helpful.
Mm. No, that's good, seeing the positive in it.
And believe me, it really hurts when you've shot a bunch of it and the shots are great and the performance is great and you love this person and don't want to cut them out of the movie. It really hurts, but yeah, worth it. Necessary.
Worth it in the end.
Yeah. Well, the end result was an absolutely mind-blowingly fantastic film. So check out the link in the episode notes to watch The Carmen Line. You can also find a link to our written review as well, so please do check that out as well. But shall we move on to your pick? Do you want to tell us which film you want to talk about?
Oh, this film. The Eagleman Stag by Mikey Please. Which, it's the funniest thing. The first film I ever made was about a penis growing in a garden. And the genius who made the penis was a man called Dan Martin, who still does incredible effects stuff today. One of his films is The Human Centipede 2. And he worked at the time at, is it the RCA or like a branch of the RCA? He was teaching physical effects in one of the major art schools, and I went to visit him in their workshop. And I'm 90% sure that Mikey was in front of me working on this film, and we had a quick chat, and we're Facebook friends. And then I think I saw it in Aspen, maybe, when I went there with Sign Language, which was a short film, the short film that won the money that made The Carmen Line, that won Virgin Media Shorts and the Reed Short Contest, and that paid for The Carmen Line. And I was at the Aspen Shorts Festival, and I saw The Eagleman Stag there. It's like having a torpedo of genius just sort of fired into your soul. It's what, 9 minutes long, and I still think, I just watched it before this, rewatched it again, and I've rewatched it countless times. And it's one of those ones, the cliche of every time I watch it, I see something else is definitely true, because it's very, very densely packed with highly thoughtful, crafted imagery and music and writing. Particularly, there's some very fast montages, which I literally, this time I stopped it on a frame I've never looked at as much, and seen just how much work went into this thing that was on screen for way less than a second, like barely seeable. And this thing has obviously taken hours to craft, because the whole thing is handcrafted from white polystyrene or something like polystyrene. It's all white, black and white, because it's physically black and white, and it makes various jokes about that. But more than that, more than just you see new things in it every time. Yeah, I'll say it's, I can think of very few films of any length that I would think are, I would consider better than this film, that have had as much effect as reliably. It's about things which I've continued to think about in the many years since that have developed in me into like whole areas of my thinking about life and the world, that I realized watching it again today, I was like, oh God, like, my view about this has really shifted, but it's still a huge part of my worldview. Which is sort of how we invented time, why we invented time, what time is to our species, sort of what a human being is. It's incredibly deep, while simultaneously being funny and absurd, and having David Cann in it, who's the doctor in The Carmen Line, and Wyatt, one of the reasons I got him for it, being funny and full of pathos at the same time. It's sort of an obscene nightmare of brilliance. And I just went to Mikey's website before this to check what's going on with him, and there's all these, it's these tantalizing, like this trailer for a feature he was supposed to be doing, a trailer for a TV show that he was working on, and they're all like, they were working on it, here's the trailer, it's supposed to be out already, and it isn't yet. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, somebody put this man's like larger works in the world. What's going on? But I'm sure one of them will out in the end. Like, you know, for me, it's six years since The Carmen Line, and I've made other things and put them in the world. I made the first film written by an artificial intelligence, but they're not like the full flowering of what I want to offer. And maybe that's arriving soon. Fingers crossed for me. But yeah, that's my sort of monologue, I suppose, on having just rewatched it, just how much this film means to me and how incredible I think it is.
Yeah, it is. I've used this phrase way too much, but it is actually mind-blowing. I don't know how it manages to hit that balance between expanding your perspective, talking about relativity and time, the essence of existence, and still just be one of the funniest things I've seen in recent years. Is the dry humor is on a level that you very rarely see, not in short film and quite often not in feature film either, actually.
Like I said, mining the profundity from the silly, from the absurd is something that gives me joy, and he does it over and over again, and also with incredible craft. Like the like I said, it's very dense, but by which I mean, it's one of those things, and obviously this is a bit more common in animation and Kubrick films, is there is not a frame that goes by that hasn't been carefully considered, and packed with as much as he wanted to pack it with. It doesn't mean it's all dense. Sometimes it stops and is sparse and takes a breath, and those will be some of the most powerful moments, but with incredible intention and care and craft every time. And which is why you can pause it on frames and go, oh, that's another idea. I suppose another thing that compels me is I just love ideas. I love new ideas that I haven't seen before. Like I said, I like being surprised. And every frame he's looking at, he's going, what else can I do? Not squishing the frame with things, but what hasn't been done? What would be an interesting idea? What would more fully cinematize this feeling I want to communicate?
Mm. Yeah. One of the things that is really quite interesting about it is its look, its kind of visual style. On the face of it, it's quite simple, but when you actually really pay attention, you realize how insanely complex it is. The level of detail is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's just kind of just the look of them, you know, everyone's quite angular, and you know, you don't have the smooth sort of photorealistic movement and texturing and stuff that you'd see in, say, a Pixar film or something like that. But when you actually see what's being done, when you realize the granular detail, I have absolutely, I don't know how they're not still making it now. It's yeah.
So much. Well, the feature which is hilariously is I just saw their trailer for, appears to be, actually it's a TV show, I forget which is which, but anyway, it appears to be about a boy who isn't affected by gravity. It's not the same as the Kármán line in that he's not moving straight upwards, but he's floating around. So, you know, okay. Mike is about to take my own territory and slam dunk mic drop it harder than I did, and then I'll cry, but it's fine. I don't think it's about grief, but anyway, it's... Yeah, and that shares the visual style. And actually, one of the thoughts I had for the first time watching it today, I often think about how, you know, again, we've got this agreement that we've made to mainly think about cinema as this realist immersion, because we can. But what a lot of really great filmmakers have known, I think, instinctively, or more than instinctively, is like they've known that our great storytellers that have taken us on great journeys forever have used hand waving or glove puppets or like simple half drawings of things. And why is that effective? Because it engages our own imagination in more detail, like to do more of the filling in, which is happening the whole time you're watching a film anyway. You fill outside of the frame and you fill in what you hear. You're like, you hear the ocean, you sort of half see the ocean in your mind. Weirdly, by taking things away, everything you take away makes what's left stronger, right? He takes out the color, he takes out he simplifies the geometry. And in doing so, I think, yeah, your imagination is going to do more work, and you're going to be more, engaged is the wrong word, you're more of a sort of collaborator, a co-creator of your experience. Yes.
Mm. Mm.
I've always loved the radio for this reason, and radio drama in particular. And yeah, I think it's using some of the tricks of radio drama in that way.
Okay. Yeah. George, what were some of your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I loved it. I actually agree with you there, Oscar, about how sort of watching it sort of made you realise how much it stuck with you and things you've done. A similar story for me in that regard would be the short story about the egg. Don't know if you're familiar with that one. quite a well-known one, but same with this. I was absolutely enthralled and sucked in to all of the trippy goings on in front of me, and it was like what I've written down here is that it was the whole short was unsettling, but in a good way. Like, I was quite comfortable feeling uncomfortable for the whole 9 minutes, seeing all of these scenes displayed in front of me, and the score behind it as well, the violins getting louder and louder and the orchestral behind it just adding to those moments of sort of almost terror, before, again, like you said, taking a breath, giving you a moment and being sucked into such small scenery, but sometimes very busy as well. Like you said, when you pause it, since you said that, I've just been clicking through it on the other screen to look at loads of different frames to see if there's something I missed. And I'm actually very much looking forward for lockdown to ending so I can show people this film, because one of my favorite things is finding a short like this one and then watching my friends watch it so I can see their reactions and what they take from it. And this is that kind of film that I definitely want to see. I want to see what they think.
Yeah, I have various friends. I have an old friend who I met at that Aspen Festival, which again was like, what, 7, 8, 9 years ago? I don't know. And he still, like me, shows that to other people more often than anything else, in a way of like, not only will you love this, but it will help me. It will help you get me as a person, I think is one of the reasons he does that. It's like, if you like this as much as I expect you to, then we will be closer for it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Sharing experiences like that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the part that always kind of sticks out whenever I rewatch it is quite close to the beginning, where he's having his fourth birthday, and it's the most restrained tantrum ever. He's just been told that he can't have another birthday party for another quarter of his life.
Which is just that one. Just that one goddamn sentence, with a lot of the gems in the script, is such a clever, simple piece of writing for capturing the whole theme. A quarter of your life. Well, a quarter according to what length of your life? It's immediately introduces you, but not with direct cognitive engagement because it's so early, to the premise of the film, which is that time is proportional to your total existence, contextual to your total experience. And by the way that gets extrapolated, that the way that speaks to genuinely what it might be to be a baby in the womb, essentially, which is one of the first images in the film, that there might be some sort of really important thinking in the idea that a conscious being, before it's had the opportunity to apply its consciousness to anything, doesn't use time, exists in an infinite now, which, I don't know, spiritual teachers for millennia, and more recently like Eckhart Tolle or someone, have been trying to encourage human beings to return to that infinite moment of the present, which is not a million miles from what the whole film is obsessed with, like trying to be in a weighty experience. And that's something that the film sort of argues, and these teachers might argue, is sort of always there available for you, but instead we get more and more addicted to living in the long past we've had and the future we anticipate. Something that I used to say a lot about, sort of why I found film interesting, as one of the things that we'd, you know, obviously it's a bunch of accidents. Like, film is just, the fact it's 2 hours long is more related to the bladder than anything else, and it's the fact it's an important institution is a sort of historical accident to some extent, but I did still find it so interesting because I used to argue that it was the laboratory of philosophy, or that fiction in general was the laboratory of philosophy, and that the reason for that is that philosophy are most detailed and passionate and thoughtful consideration of what the world is and what the human experience is. Philosophy can only claim and argue things, whereas fiction is able to embody them. And in embodying them, essentially attempt to demonstrate their truthfulness. So you can come up with an idea about like what the world is, and to do with, you know, this film talks about time and immediacy and presence and whatever. But just telling someone those things or writing a kind of essay about it, they might think, oh yes, and compare it to some of their experiences, but they're not going to get the visceral test of it that fiction and in particular film can bring you into. That cinematization moment can say, let's make these ideas into a real experience you're having right now. And if that feels recognizable and truthful to you, then maybe we're onto something. Of course, it's worth remembering that these same tools can breathe truth into things that can be unhelpful and destructive too. But it is a place for us to experiment with them.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start wrapping it up, actually. I mean, I could actually sit and listen to you talk about this film in particular all day. George, did you have any final thoughts on the film?
Hopefully I don't drop off before I try and talk about them. There's not much more that can be said other than the fact that, yeah, it's going to stick with me, like I said, and I want to show people. I want to show people because I want to talk with my people as well in the exact same way. I want to talk with them about it and see what they think about it as well. I just think it's brilliant, like just every single bit of it, even down to the description on IMDb. If you repeat the word fly for long enough, it sounds like you're saying life, which obviously is a key part of the film when he says that. And it wasn't really till afterwards that I kind of realized what that moment was meant to sort of mean and what it was actually meant to portray. And I just love that. I'm definitely going to watch it again. So it's a complete recommendation for me, obviously.
So we're going to sign off, and until next time, it's goodbye from George.
Goodbye, everyone. Goodbye, fans of short film.
And it's goodbye from Oscar.
A little bit.
Thank you so much, guys, and we'll see you soon.
That was Oscar Sharp and our homegrown stable genius, George Moll. We really hope you enjoyed the interview. Our thanks to Oscar Sharp for joining us, and our thanks to both Oscar and Mikey Please for their permission to use clips of their respective films for the video edition of this episode. And thanks also, as always, to George for taking part in the interview. You can watch both films by clicking the links in the episode notes, and if you want to catch more of our attempts to wax lyrical about all things short film, then please subscribe to our podcast by heading to cameolaunch.com/podcast, where you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, Deezer, and many more. You can also subscribe on YouTube for our video episodes. The link is in the episode notes. And don't forget to hit the bell to make sure you're notified when new episodes are posted. And if it's written interviews you're after, then head over to cameolaunch.com/reviews, where you can find write-ups of all of our short film recommendations. You can also create a profile for yourself on our site that will allow you to add likes to your favorite reviews and shorts, leave comments, and get notified about new postings. You can also subscribe to our newsletter via our site so you can stay up to date with all of the new goings on, from podcasts to reviews to additions to our online shop. We've just gotten a bunch of new items we know you'll love, including the Jean-Luc Godard collection on Blu-ray, Akira Kurosawa's Ren, beautifully restored in high definition, provocative documentary Room 237, which takes you behind the scenes of Stanley Kubrick's seminal classic The Shining. And if it's seminal classics from Stanley Kubrick you're after, we also have a special edition behind-the-scenes book chronicling the making of A Clockwork Orange, which also features a DVD of the film itself. Head over to cameolaunch.com/shop to check out all of that, plus more. We're going to be back to our usual hijinks next episode, but if you're hooked on that sweet filmmaker wisdom, then come on back for the following episode, where I'll be speaking to filmmaker Gage Oxley, writer, director, and showrunner of the short film anthology A Series of Light, currently available on Amazon Prime Video. Thank you once again for tuning in. Keep your eyes and ears open for our next episode, and as always, please stay safe, and we'll catch you next time.